Chapter 5. Wild Bill Wharton took his first trip down to the restraint room the very next day. He spent the morning and afternoon being as quiet and good as Mary's little lamb, a state we soon discovered was not natural with him and meant trouble. Then, around 7:30 that evening, Harry felt something warm splash on the cuffs of uniform pants he had put on clean just that day. It was piss. William Wharton was standing at his cell, showing his darkening teeth in a wide grin, and pissing all over Harry Terwilliger's pants and shoes.
"The dirty son of a bitch must have been saving it up all day," Harry said later, still disgusted and outraged.
Well, that was it. It was time to show William Wharton who ran the show on E-Block. Harry got Brutal and me, and I alerted Dean and Percy, who were also on. We had three prisoners by then, remember, and were into what we called full coverage, with my group on from 7 in the evening to 3 in the morning, when trouble was most apt to break out, and two other crews covering the rest of the day. Those other crews consisted mostly of floaters, with Bill Dodge usually in charge. It wasn't a bad way to run things, all in all, and I felt that once I could shift Percy over to Days, life would be even better. I never got around to that, however. I sometimes wonder if it would have changed things if I had. Anyway, there was a big water main in the storage room on the side away from old Sparky, and Dean and Percy hooked up a length of canvas fire hose to it, and they stood by the valve that would open it if needed. Brutal and I hurried down to Wharton's cell, where Wharton still stood, still grinning and still with his tool hanging out of his pants. I had liberated the straitjacket from the restraint room and tossed it on a shelf in my office last thing before going home the night before, thinking we might be needing it for our new problem child. Now I had it in one hand, my index finger hooked under one of the canvas straps. Harry came behind us, hauling the nozzle of the fire hose, which ran back through my office, down the storage room steps, and to the drum, where Dean and Percy were paying it out as fast as they could.
"Hey, y'all like that?"
Wild Bill asked. He was laughing like a kid at a carnival, laughing so hard he could barely talk. Big tears went rolling down his cheeks.
"Come on so fast, I guess you must have. I'm currently cooking some turds to go with it. Nice soft ones. I'll have my tea all tomorrow."
He saw that I was unlocking his cell door, and his eyes narrowed. He saw that Brutal was holding his revolver in one hand and his nightstick in the other, and they narrowed even more.
"You can come in here on your legs, but you go out on your backs. Billy the Kid is going to guarantee you that,"
he told us. His eyes shifted back to me.
"And if you think you're going to put that nut coat on me, you got another thing coming, old hoss."
"You're not the one who says go or jump back around here," I told him. "You should know that, but I guess you're too dumb to pick it up without a little teaching." I finished unlocking the door and ran it back on its track. Wharton retreated to the bunk, his cock still hanging out of his pants, put his hands out to me, palms up, then beckoned with his fingers.
"Come on, you ugly motherfucker," he said. "They be schooling all right, but this old boy's well set up to be the teacher."
He shifted his gaze and his dark-toothed grin to Brutal.
"Come on, big fella, you first. This time you can't sneak up behind me. Put down that gun, you ain't gonna shoot it anyway, not you. And we'll go man to man. See who's the better fella."
Brutal stepped into the cell, but not toward Wharton. He moved to the left once he was through the door, and Wharton's narrow eyes widened as he saw the fire hose pointed at him.
"No, you don't," he said.
"Oh, no, you don't, Dean," I yelled. "Turn it on all the way."
Wharton jumped forward, and Brutal hit him a good smart lick, the kind of lick I'm sure Percy dreamed of, across his forehead, laying his baton right over Wharton's eyebrows. Wharton, who seemed to think we'd never seen trouble until we'd seen him, went to his knees, his eyes open but blind. Then the water came, Harry staggering back a step under its power, and then holding steady, the nozzle firm in his hands, pointed like a gun. The stream caught Wild Bill Wharton square in the middle of his chest, spun him halfway around, and drove him back under his bunk. Down the hall, Delacroix was jumping from foot to foot, cackling shrilly and cursing at John Coffey, demanding that Coffey tell him what was going on, who was winning, and how that grand fou new boy liked that Chinese water treatment. John said nothing, just stood there quietly in his two short pants and his prison slippers. I only had one quick glance at him, but that was enough to observe his same old expression, both sad and serene. It was as if he'd seen the whole thing before, not just once or twice, but 1,000 times.
"Kill the water!"
Brutal shouted back over his shoulder, then raced forward into the cell. He sank his hands into the semi-conscious Wharton's armpits and dragged him out from under his bunk. Wharton was coughing and making a glub-glub sound. Blood was dribbling into his dazed eyes from above his brows, where Brutal's stick had popped the skin open in a line. We had the straitjacket business down to a science, did Brutus Howell and me. We'd practiced it like a couple of vaudeville hoofers working up a new dance routine. Every now and then, that practice paid off. Now, for instance. Brutal sat Wharton up and held out his arms toward me the way a kid might hold out the arms of a Raggedy Andy doll. Awareness was just starting to seep back into Wharton's eyes, the knowledge that if he didn't start fighting right away, it was going to be too late. But the lines were still down between his brain and his muscles, and before he could repair them, I had rammed the sleeves of the coat up his arms, and Brutal was doing the buckles up the back. While he took care of that, I grabbed the cuff straps, pulled Wharton's arms around his sides, and linked his wrists together with another canvas strap. He ended up looking like he was hugging himself.
"God damn you, big dummy! How they doing with him?" Delacroix screamed.
I heard Mr. Jingles squeaking, as if he wanted to know, too. Percy arrived, his shirt wet and sticking to him from his struggles with the water main, his face glowing with excitement. Dean came along behind him, wearing a bracelet of purplish bruise around his throat and looking a lot less thrilled. "Come on now, Wild Bill," I said, and yanked Wharton to his feet. "Little walkie-walkie."
"Don't you call me that!"
Wharton screamed shrilly, and I think that for the first time we were seeing real feelings, and not just a clever animal's camouflage spots.
"Wild Bill Hickok wasn't no range rider. He never fought him no bear with a bowie knife either. He was just another bushwhacking John Law. Dumb son of a bitch sat with his back to the door and got killed by a drunk."
"Oh, my suds and body, a history lesson," Brutal exclaimed and shoved Wharton out of his cell. "A fella just never knows what he's going to get when he clocks in here, only that it's apt to be nice. But with so many nice people like you around, I guess that kind of stands to reason, don't it? And you know what? Pretty soon you'll be history yourself, Wild Bill. Meantime, you get on down the hall. We got a room for you. Kind of a cooling-off room." Wharton gave a furious, inarticulate scream and threw himself at Brutal, even though he was snugly buckled into the coat now and his arms were wrapped around behind him. Percy made to draw his baton, the Wetmore solution for all of life's problems, and Dean put a hand on his wrist. Percy gave him a puzzled, half-indignant look, as if to say that after what Wharton had done to Dean, Dean should be the last person in the world to want to hold him back. Brutal pushed Wharton backward. I caught him and pushed him to Harry. And Harry propelled him on down the Green Mile, past the staring Delacroix and the impassive coffee. Wharton ran to keep from falling on his face, spitting curses the whole way, spitting them the way a welder's torch spits sparks. We banged him into the last cell on the right while Dean, Harry, and Percy, who for once wasn't complaining about being unfairly overworked, yanked all of the crap out of the restraint room. While they did that, I had a brief conversation with Wharton. "You think you're tough," I said. "And maybe you are, Sonny, but in here, tough don't matter. Your stampeding days are over. If you take it easy on us, we'll take it easy on you. If you make it hard, you'll die in the end just the same, but we'll sharpen you like a pencil before you go."
"You're gonna be so happy to see the end of me,"
Wharton said in a hoarse voice. He was struggling against the straitjacket, even though he must have known it would do no good, and his face was red as a tomato.
"And until I'm gone, I'll make your lives miserable."
He bared his teeth at me like an angry baboon. "If that's all you want, to make our lives miserable, you can quit now, because you've already succeeded," Brutal said. "But as far as your time on the mile goes, Wharton, we don't care if you spend all of it in the room with the soft walls. And you can wear that damn nut coat until your arms gangrene from lack of circulation and fall right off. He paused. No one much comes down here, you know. And if you think anyone gives much of a shit what happens to you one way or another, you best reconsider, cowboy. To the world in general, you're already one dead outlaw. Wharton was studying Brutal carefully, and the collar was fading out of his face.
"Let me out of it,"
he said in a placatory voice, a voice too sane and too reasonable to trust.
"I'll be good, honest Injun."
Harry appeared in the cell doorway. The end of the corridor looked like a rummage sale, but we'd set things to rights with good speed once we got started. We had before. We knew the drill.
"All ready,"
Harry said. Brutal grabbed the bulge in the canvas where Wharton's right elbow was and yanked him to his feet.
"Come on, Wild Billy, and look on the good side. You're going to have at least 24 hours to remind yourself never to sit with your back to the door and never to hold on to no aces and eights."
"Let me out of it," Wharton said.
He looked from Brutal to Harry to me, the red creeping back into his face.
"I'll be good. I'll tell you, I've learned my lesson.
He suddenly collapsed, half of him in the cell, half of him on the played-out lino of the Green Mile, kicking his feet and bucking his body.
"Holy Christ, he's pitching a fit,"
Percy whispered.
"Sure, and my sister's the Whore of Babylon," Brutal said. "She dances the hoochie-coochie for Moses on Saturday nights in a long white veil."
He bent down and hooked a hand into one of Wharton's armpits. I got the other one. Wharton threshed between us like a hooked fish. Carrying his jerking body, listening to him grunt from one end and fart from the other, was one of my life's less pleasant experiences. I looked up and met John Coffey's eyes for a second. They were bloodshot, and his dark cheeks were wet. He had been crying again. I thought of Hammersmith making that biting gesture with his hand and shivered a little. Then I turned my attention back to Wharton. We threw him into the restraint room like he was cargo, and watched him lie on the floor, bucking hard in the straitjacket, next to the drain we had once checked for the mouse which had started its Block E life as Steamboat Willie.
"I don't much care if he swallows his tongue or something and dies,"
Dean said in his hoarse and raspy voice.
"But think of the paperwork, boys, it'd never end."
"Never mind the paperwork, think of the hearing,"
Harry said gloomily.
"We'd lose our damn jobs. End up picking peas down Mississippi. You know what Mississippi is, don't you? It's the Indian word for asshole."
"He ain't gonna die, and he ain't gonna swallow his tongue either," Brutal said. "When we open this door tomorrow, he's gonna be just fine. Take my word for it." That's just the way it was, too. The man we took back to his cell the next night at 9 was quiet, pallid, and seemingly chastened. He walked with his head down, made no effort to attack anyone when the straitjacket came off, and only stared listlessly at me when I told him it would go just the same the next time, and he just had to ask himself how much time he wanted to spend pissing in his pants and eating baby food a spoonful at a time.
"I'll be good, boss. I learnt my lesson,"
he whispered in a humble little voice as we put him back in his cell. Brutal looked at me and winked. Late the next day, William Wharton, who was Billy the Kid to himself, and never that bushwhacking John Law Wild Bill Hickok, bought a moon pie from old Toot Toot. He had been expressly forbidden any such commerce, but the afternoon crew was composed of floaters, as I think I have said, and the deal went down. Toot himself undoubtedly knew better, but to him the snack wagon was always a case of a nickel is a nickel, a dime is a dime. I'd sing another chorus, but I don't have the time. That night, when Brutal ran his check round, Wharton was standing at the door of his cell. He waited until Brutal looked up at him, then slammed the heels of his hands into his bulging cheeks and shot a thick and amazingly long stream of chocolate sludge into Brutal's face. He had crammed the entire moon pie into his trap, held it there until it liquefied, and then used it like chewing tobacco. Wharton fell back on his bunk, wearing a chocolate goatee, kicking his legs and screaming with laughter, and pointing to Brutal, who was wearing a lot more than a goatee.
"Lil' Black Sambo, yassa, boss, yassa, how do you do?"
Wharton held his belly and howled,
"Gah! gosh, if it had only been Kaka! I wish it had been. If I'd had me some of that...
You are Kaka, Brutal growled, and I hope you got your bags packed, because you're going back down to your favorite toilet. Once again, Wharton was bundled into the straitjacket, and once again we stowed him in the room with the soft walls. 2 days this time. Sometimes we could hear him raving in there. Sometimes we could hear him promising that he'd be good, that he'd come to his senses and be good. And sometimes we could hear him screaming that he needed a doctor, that he was dying. Mostly, though, he was silent. And he was silent when we took him out again, too, walking back to his cell with his head down and his eyes dull, not responding when Harry said, "Remember, it's up to you." He would be all right for a while, and then he'd try something else. There was nothing he did that hadn't been tried before. Well, except for the thing with the moon pie, maybe, even Brutal admitted that was pretty original. But his sheer persistence was scary. I was afraid that sooner or later someone's attention might lapse and there would be hell to pay. And the situation might continue for quite a while, because somewhere he had a lawyer who was beating the bushes, telling folks how wrong it would be to kill this fella upon whose brow the dew of youth had not yet dried, and who was, incidentally, as white as John Brown. There was no sense complaining about it, because keeping Wharton out of the chair was his lawyer's job. Keeping him safely jugged was ours. And in the end, old Sparky would almost certainly have him, lawyer or no lawyer. Chapter 6. That was the week Melinda Moores, the warden's wife, came home from Indianola. The doctors were done with her. They had had their interesting, newfangled X-ray photographs of the tumor in her head. They had documented the weakness in her hand and the paralyzing pains that racked her almost constantly by then, and were done with her. They gave her husband a bunch of pills with morphine in them and sent Melinda home to die. Hal Moore's had some sick leave piled up. Not a lot, they didn't give you a lot in those days. But he took what he had so he could help her do what she had to do. My wife and I went to see her 3 days or so after she came home. I called ahead, and Hal said yes, that would be fine. Melinda was having a pretty good day and would enjoy seeing us. "I hate calls like this," I said to Janice as we drove to the little house where the Moorses had spent most of their marriage. "So does everyone, honey," she said, and patted my hand. "We'll bear up under it, and so will she." "I hope so." We found Melinda in the sitting room, planted in a bright slant of unseasonably warm October sun, and my first shocked thought was that she had lost 90 pounds. She hadn't, of course. If she'd lost that much weight, she hardly would have been there at all. But that was my brain's initial reaction to what my eyes were reporting. Her face had fallen away to show the shape of the underlying skull, and her skin was as white as parchment. There were dark circles under her eyes, and it was the first time I ever saw her in her rocker when she didn't have a lap full of sewing or Afghan squares or rags for braiding into a rug. She was just sitting there, like a person in a train station.
"Melinda,"
my wife said warmly. I think she was as shocked as I was, more, perhaps. But she hid it splendidly, as some women seem able to do. She went to Melinda, dropped on one knee beside the rocking chair in which the warden's wife sat, and took one of her hands. As she did, my eye happened upon the blue hearthrug by the fireplace. It occurred to me that it should have been the shade of tired old limes, because now this room was just another version of the Green Mile.
"I brought you some tea," Jan said. "The kind I put up myself. It's a nice sleepy tea. I've left it in the kitchen."
"Thank you so much, darling," Melinda said. Her voice sounded old and rusty.
"How you feeling, dear?"
my wife asked.
"Better,"
Melinda said in her rusty, grating voice.
"Not so's I want to go out to a barn dance, but at least there's no pain today. May give me some pills for the headaches. Sometimes they even work."
"That's good, isn't it?" but I can't grip so well. Something's happened to my hand."
She raised it, looked at it as if she had never seen it before, and lowered it back into her lap.
"Something's happened all over me."
She began to cry in a soundless way that made me think of John Coffey. It started to chime in my head again, that thing he'd said. "I helped it, didn't I? I helped it, didn't I?" Like a rhyme you can't get rid of. Hal came in then. He collared me, and you can believe me when I say I was glad to be collared. We went into the kitchen, and he poured me half a shot of white whiskey. Hot stuff, fresh out of some countryman's still. We clinked our glasses together and drank. The shine went down like coal oil, but the bloom in the belly was heaven. Still, when Moores tipped the mason jar at me, wordlessly asking if I wanted the other half, I shook my head and waved it off. Wild Bill Wharton was out of restraints, for the time being anyway, and it wouldn't be safe to go near where he was with a booze-clouded head, not even with bars between us.
"I don't know how long I can take this, Paul," he said in a low voice. "There's a girl who comes in mornings to help me with her, but the doctors say she may lose control of her bowels, and...
He stopped, his throat working, trying hard not to cry in front of me again.
"Go with it as best you can," I said.
I reached out across the table and briefly squeezed his palsied, liver-spotted hand. "Do that day by day, and give the rest over to God. There's nothing else you can do, is there?"
"I guess not. But it's hard, Paul. I pray you never have to find out how hard."
He made an effort to collect himself.
"Now tell me the news. How are you doing with William Wharton, and how are you making out with Percy Wetmore?"
We talked shop for a while and got through the visit. After, all the way home, with my wife sitting silent for the most part, wet-eyed and thoughtful in the passenger seat beside me, Coffee's words ran around in my head like Mr. Jingles running around in Delacroix's cell.
"I helped it, didn't I?"
"It's terrible,"
my wife said dully at one point.
"And there's nothing anyone can do to help her."
I nodded agreement and thought, "I helped it, didn't I?" But that was crazy, and I tried as best I could to put it out of my mind. As we turned into our dooryard, she finally spoke a second time. Not about her old friend Melinda, but about my urinary infection. She wanted to know if it was really gone. "Really gone," I told her, "cured."
"That's fine, then," she said,
and kissed me over the eyebrow in that shivery place of mine.
"Maybe we ought to, you know, get up to a little something. If you have the time and the inclination, that is."
Having plenty of the latter and just enough of the former, I took her by the hand and led her into the back bedroom and took her clothes off as she stroked the part of me that swelled and throbbed but didn't hurt any more. And as I moved in her sweetness, slipping through it in that slow way she liked, that we both liked, I thought of John Coffey, saying he'd helped it. He'd helped it, hadn't he? Like a snatch of song that won't leave your mind until it's damned good and ready. Later, as I drove to the prison, I got to thinking that very soon we would have to start rehearsing for Delacroix's execution. That thought led to how Percy was going to be out front this time, and I felt a shiver of dread. I told myself to just go with it. One execution and we'd very likely be shut of Percy Wetmore for good, but still I felt that shiver, as if the infection I'd been suffering with wasn't gone at all, but had only switched locations, from boiling my groin to freezing my backbone. Chapter 7.
"Come on,"
Brutal told Delacroix the following evening.
"'We're going for a little walk, you and me and Mr. Jingles.'
Delacroix looked at him distrustfully, then reached down into the cigar box for the mouse. He cupped it in the palm of one hand and looked at Brutal with narrow eyes.
"'What you talking about?'
"'It's a big night for you and Mr. Jingles,' Dean said, as he and Harry joined Brutal. The chain of bruises around Dean's neck had gone an unpleasant yellow color, but at least he could talk again without sounding like a dog barking at a cat. He looked at Brutal.
"'Think we ought to put the shackles on him, Brute?'
Brutal appeared to consider.
"'No,' he said at last. "'He's gonna be good, ain't you, Del? You and the mouse both. After all, you're gonna be showing off with some high muckamucks tonight.'
Percy and I were standing up by the duty desk, watching this, Percy with his arms folded and a small, contemptuous smile on his lips. After a bit, he took out his horn comb and went to work on his hair with it. John Coffey was watching, too, standing silently at the bars of his cell. Wharton was lying on his bunk, staring up at the ceiling and ignoring the whole show. He was still being good, although what he called good was what the docs at Briar Ridge called catatonic. And there was one other person there as well. He was tucked out of sight in my office, but his skinny shadow fell out the door and onto the green mile.
"'What dis about you, Gonfou?'
Del asked querulously, drawing his feet up on the bunk as Brutal undid the double locks on his cell door and ran it open. His eyes flicked back and forth among the three of them.
"'Well, I'll tell you,' Brutal said. "'Mr. Moores is gone for a while. His wife is under the weather, as you may have heard. So Mr. Anderson is in charge, Mr. Curtis Anderson.'
"'Yeah?' What that got to do with me?
Well, Harry said, Boss Anderson's heard about your mouse, Del, and wants to see him perform. He and about six other fellows are over in admin, just waiting for you to show up. Not just plain old blue suit guards, either. These are pretty big bugs, just like Brute said. One of them, I believe, is a politician all the way from the state capitol.
Delacroix swelled visibly at this, and I saw not so much as a single shred of doubt on his face. Of course they wanted to see Mr. Jingles. Who would not? He scrummed around, first under his bunk and then under his pillow. He eventually found one of those big pink peppermints and the wildly colored spool. He looked at Brutal questioningly, and Brutal nodded.
"'Yep, it's the spool trick they're really wild to see, I guess. But the way he eats those mints is pretty damned cute, too. And don't forget the cigar box. You'll want it to carry him in, right?'
Delacroix got the box and put Mr. Jingle's props in it, but the mouse he settled on the shoulder of his shirt. Then he stepped out of his cell, his puffed-out chest leading the way, and regarded Dean and Harry.
"'You boys coming?'
"'Nah,' Dean said. "'Got other fish to fry. But you knock him for a loop, Del. Show him what happens when a Louisiana boy puts a hammer down and really goes to work.'
"'You bet!'
A smile shone out of his face, so sudden and so simple in its happiness, that I felt my heart break for him a little, in spite of the terrible thing he had done. What a world we live in. What a world.
Delacroix turned to John Coffey, with whom he had struck up a diffident friendship, not much different from 100 other Death House acquaintances I'd seen.
"'You knock 'em for a loop, Del,' Coffey said in a serious voice. "'You show 'em all his tricks.'
Delacroix nodded and held his hand up by his shoulder. Mr. Jingles stepped onto it like it was a platform, and Delacroix held the hand out toward Coffey's cell. John Coffey stuck out a huge finger, and I'll be damned if that mouse didn't stretch out his neck and lick the end of it just like a dog.
"'Come on, Del, quit lingering,' Brutal said. "'These folks are setting back a hot dinner at home to watch your mouse cut his capers.'
"'Not true, of course.' Anderson would have been there until 8 o'clock on any night, and the guards he'd dragged in to watch Delacroix's show would be there until 11 or 12, depending on when their shifts were scheduled to end. The politician from the state capitol would most likely turn out to be an office janitor in a borrowed tie. But Delacroix had no way of knowing any of that.
"'I'm ready,' Delacroix said, speaking with the simplicity of a great star who has somehow managed to retain the common touch.
"'Let's go.'
And as Brutal led him up the Green Mile with Mr. Jingles perched there on the little man's shoulder, Delacroix once more began to bugle,
"Messieurs et mesdames, bienvenue au Cirque des Mousies!"
Yet, even lost as deeply in his own fantasy world as he was, he gave Percy a wide berth and a mistrustful glance. Harry and Dean stopped in front of the empty cell across from Wharton's. That worthy had still not so much as stirred. They watched as Brutal unlocked the door to the exercise yard, where another two guards were waiting to join him, and led Delacroix out, bound for his command performance before the grand high poobahs of Cold Mountain Penitentiary. We waited until the door was locked again, and then I looked toward my office. That shadow was still lying on the floor, thin as famine, and I was glad Delacroix had been too excited to see it. "Come on out," I said, "and let's move along brisk, folks. I want to get two run-throughs in, and we don't have much time." Old Toot-Toot, looking as bright-eyed and bushy-tailed as ever, came out, walked to Delacroix's cell, and strolled in through the open door.
"Sittin' down," he said. "I'm sittin' down, I'm sittin' down, I'm sittin' down."
This is the real circus, I thought, closing my eyes for a second. This is the real circus right here, and we're all just a bunch of trained mice. Then I put the thought out of my mind, and we started to rehearse.